Hello and welcome to IT Conversations, a series of interviews with experts in today's hot topics in information technology. I'm your host, Doug Kay, the CEO of RDS Strategies, and my guest today is Philip Greenspun, probably best known for his 1999 book, Philip and Alex's Guide to Web Publishing. Philip has co-authored a new book entitled Software Engineering for Internet Applications. Hello, Philip, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Philip and Alex's Guide to Web Publishing is certainly one of the most unusual computer books ever published. For those listeners who haven't been able to read it, the book is filled with color photographs that at least literally have nothing to do with web publishing. It's printed on high-quality coated stock. I weighed it the other day. It weighs a hefty 3.5 pounds. In fact, I've heard it described as the first coffee table computer book. How did you manage to work out a deal with Morgan Kaufman to publish such a unique book? But more importantly, tell us how did you create that concept?
Well, the book was available. All my books are available free online. So the question was, how do you get people to pay for something in a bookstore that they could just download off the web for free? And we decided that everybody had a laser printer so they could print out a black and white version quite easily. But not everybody had a high-quality color printer or high-quality paper stock, so that we better make the hard copy something that people would be happy to own. So that was actually the genesis, just thinking about what does it mean to sell a hard copy version of something that's free online to anybody, anywhere in the world, 24 hours a day.
Now, the book is also written in an unusual style. I'd call it perhaps a stream of consciousness approach to teaching the technology of dynamic websites. I read once you described it to me, as a catalog of mistakes. How did you come to adopt that particular style of writing an exposition? It seems to have carried over into your latest book as well.
Well, I hope not. I mean, the latest book, Software Engineering for Internet Apps, is a textbook with a very specific audience of, you know, undergraduates in computer science at MIT and other schools. And it's really organized around the user, you know, what is a minimum of the reader, what's the minimum number of words they can read in order to get the concepts across. I try to make it informal and not stuffy, but basically that's really a reader-centric book. With Philip and Alex's Guide, there was such a broad variety of people who might have wanted to read it. You know, in the 90s, there were so many different kinds of people who were interested in Internet applications, decision-makers, artists, writers, thinkers, programmers, that it was hard to figure out who the reader was going to be, and in fact, it was picked up by quite a few people who read different parts. So instead, it's kind of organized around different things that I had experience with. So I just wrote down everything that I knew, and that was the book, organized as best I could. But, you know, in retrospect, I kind of wish I'd written three books, you know, one for the business person, one for the programmer, and one for maybe the creative content producer.
It's not often that one can read a book on technology and get such, or develop such a sense of empathy for the author. Did you get a lot of reaction to it, or have you had a lot of reaction since it came out?
I have had a lot of reaction, mostly to the free online version as opposed to the hard copy version. I think when people buy something in a bookstore and take it home, they feel like the transaction is complete. They paid for the book, and they've got the book. When they get something for free online, you know, they feel that they still owe the author something. So, you know, when they're done, they'll often send you an email saying, well, you know, I had this question, and, you know, chapter 14 of your book really helped me out, and thanks a lot. So I've gotten a lot of feedback, but I don't think I would have gotten nearly as much if the book hadn't been online.
How well do you feel the content has held up over the last 5 years?
That's painful. I think sometimes in looking back at that book, I feel like the people who saw early television and said, you know, this medium is going to be great. It's going to be filled with lectures from Harvard and Yale, and people everywhere in the country will be able to learn 24 hours a day from this fantastic new medium. And, you know, obviously it turned out to be Jerry Springer that was more popular than Harvard lectures on history and literature, I really thought of and still think of the internet as a place where the technology can be used to increase the number of teachers. You know, on photo.net, for example, which is the first online community I started, if you're a photographer in Paris and you're reading the site and you see a question by somebody, an American who's going to be a tourist there, and they say, where should I get my film developed? Well, you can answer that question because you live there and you have experience. So, you know, a person who doesn't think of himself as a teacher now is acting in that role because of the online community. And as it happened, though, you know, that hasn't been, except for America Online, which is a very popular online community, that hasn't been people's overwhelming experience of the internet. They get content from traditional publishers, cluttered with banner ads and pop-ups. They get a lot of spam. So anyway, it's a bit of an embarrassment.
You know, my only complaint about the book is that I didn't find it earlier. You know, at a time when, and today, most books will tell you how something works, but there are very few books that will tell you how you should use the tools.
Yeah, the tools and the concepts haven't changed. I mean, the things that I was trying to teach people that were technical haven't changed at all. You know, it's still basically the relational database management system is still the core technology that enables publishers of interactive web services, where there's reader-to-reader collaboration that lets them manage the concurrency of, say, 1,000 readers all responding to a posting at once or placing a bid on a classified ad or whatever. So in that sense, the book's focus on relational database management systems has held up very well, and you know, that's a technology that really hasn't changed much since the early 1970s. And also the web programming stuff, I try to give people a flavor for different styles of merging HTML templates and information from the relational database. And again, that technique hasn't changed.
You mentioned photo.net. This is a site that you built, I think it's been about 10 years now, well before most of us had heard of the World Wide Web. What was your original vision for that, and how has that site evolved over these past 10 years?
Well, I was always very interested in multi-user computer applications, going back 20 years or more. And, you know, in the old days, you had the internet, and there were thousands of computers connected up to it, even in the early 80s. But they were heterogeneous in terms of their operating systems and user interface. So, in other words, you know, maybe 5% of the computers were Sun workstations, and 5% were DEC mainframes, and 5% were, IBM mainframes. So basically, it was very hard to write a program that had a rich user interface that any significant number of people could use. When the Macintosh came out, you know, some of those were hooked up to the web, to the internet, and you know, you could write a Macintosh app, but it wouldn't work on the Unix workstations or on Windows machines. So the web was very exciting to me, and you know, I immediately, upon playing with it starting in 1993, I immediately said, well, this will be interesting for literature, for people to write something and then get reader reactions and have them be automatically incorporated back into the text, with some kind of editing process as well, but basically collaboratively created works of text. And I kind of backed in accidentally into photo.net. I had a book that I wrote for my friends and family while I was driving to Alaska and back in the summer of 93 called Travels with Samantha, and a lot of people looked at the book, probably because there was nothing else to look at on the web. Way back, I had the book and a lot of pictures in line, so people who wanted to see an online book, that was one of the few choices. A lot of them emailed me with questions about photography. How did you take a picture of that bear? How did you get that wide-angle photo of that landscape? And as I was emailing them back, I thought, well, you know, it would be a lot more efficient if I programmed a little question-and-answer forum on this service that you know, they could post their question into an HTML form, and it would appear on the site, and then I could post an answer. And then, you know, new people who had a similar question would see the old question and they could learn from that and either ask a different question, or maybe they would just be able to go away satisfied with their question answered. So, you know, it became what became basically a place for, you know, some things that I had written eventually became a place for photographers to talk to each other.
Do you have any quantitative sense of how popular it is, how many visitors you get?
Oh, well, I'm not running it anymore. I kind of ducked out in the year 2000 so that I could do other things. But I think there's a few hundred thousand subscribers. I know it gets more than 10 million hits a day. And I think it gets probably about 400,000 different people visiting every month. So it's a medium popular site. You know, nothing like the NewYorkTimes.com or CNN.com or eBay or whatever. You know, pretty popular given the narrowness of the interest, which is fairly high-end amateur photography.
Still a hefty number of zeros in there.
Yes, and a hefty number of zeros in your bank account if you pay for all that bandwidth. That's one of the cruelties of running an online community. The more popular it is, you know, I think the site right now is consuming more than 10 megabits per second continuously. So it, I'm sure the hosting bill is over $1,000 a month for all that bandwidth.
And what hardware is it running on, just for curiosity?
The guys who were taking it over, who took it over, they have just switched to some dual processor Pentium machine to run the database, which is Oracle. And then they have maybe four front-end machines, each of which is, 2 gigahertz Pentium or something, and then there's a load balancing router. So it's probably roughly 7 or 8 CPUs now serving all those people.
You know, you mentioned Travels with Samantha. This is another book that you published online. It's all about your travels in North America. It's still very popular. Why don't you first tell us who, or shall I say, what Samantha is, and what this book really means to you?
Well, of course, there's a famous North American travel log, which I hadn't read at the time, but I knew the title. It was Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck, and Charlie was his poodle, standard poodle. So I thought, well, I had to give a name to the collection of letters I'd written back to my friends and family, and my dog had... I'd wanted to go with my dog on the trip, but he actually died a couple of years beforehand, and...
That was George, right?
That was George. I was traveling alone, but I had this Macintosh PowerBook that I was taking along and using for the writing and connecting to the internet. And so I'd been in New Zealand, and I had spent so much time with my computer that these German girls teased me and said, you know, what's her name? So I said, it's a computer. It doesn't have a name. And they said, come on, what's the name? And I said, well, I always wanted a girlfriend named Samantha, so. We'll call her Samantha.
I mean, the book is a very Kerouac-style American travelogue. I was really surprised and impressed with it. I mean, just reading about, you know, the death of George in the beginning was gripping and compelling, and it's probably what, you know, sucked me into reading the whole thing. There's a very consistent style in all of your writing, whether it's about scripting languages or the people and places you've seen. The style is journalistic, not like in journalism, but as in writing a journal. In fact, your style is sort of a 10-year-old diary that reads more like the weblogs that we see today, wouldn't you say?
I think that's fair. You know, I didn't really see the weblog revolution coming because it all seemed so easy for me. You know, it took me 20 minutes to put up my first web page. That included, you know, looking at somebody else's HTML, figuring out how the language works, replacing his text with mine, saving it into a different directory, and, you know, I had my website. So it never occurred to me that, you know, relatively minor changes in how you allow people to author would cause such a revolution. But blogs are kind of interesting. To me, the most interesting thing about the blogs is the track backing features, the fact that, you know, bloggers can comment in a structured way on each other's sites. It's kind of a distributed database of writings and comments where I had built something that was much more like the 1970s mainframe systems. Everything was centralized on my server.
Very much a broadcast model, too.
Yeah, which is how Amazon or eBay is built. You know, it's not a bad way to do things. But the blog software that, you know, Dave Weiner and others conceived is has that distributed computing innovation.
Changing subjects for a moment, MIT seems to have been your second home on and off for much of your life, it seems. I read somewhere that you've had the same email address since 1976, which according to my arithmetic, you were just 13 years old. Is that right?
That's right. I was fortunate to live in Washington, D.C., where there were dial-up connections that you could make to the ARPANET, which was the predecessor to the modern Internet. And MIT, of course, had a bunch of machines on the ARPANET, one of which ran this very interesting computer algebra program called Maxima. I suppose the thing that most people might have heard of that's similar to Maxima today is a system out of Canada called MAPLE. Basically, Maxima, MAPLE, they can do any high school calculus problem they can just do by themselves. And it's very handy for physicists who want to manipulate a lot of equations. So without, you know, making careless errors. So it doesn't necessarily do all your math for you if you're doing something advanced, but it will let you do algebra with, you know, multi-hundred term polynomials without ever making any kind of careless mistake. And they were offering accounts on their systems to anybody who wanted to use Maxima. So I signed up for a free account, and lo and behold, I had my account and my email address at the old MIT machines that ran Maxima. And then a few years later, I showed up on campus because some guys at my, I got my first programming job when I was 14, and the guys in my office, a bunch of them were MIT grads, and I liked them a lot better than the people at my high school, all of whom wanted to go to Harvard, so I said, well, I'll go to MIT. But yeah, the people, like I said, I really liked the spirit of the MIT grads. At, my first job was at the Goddard Space Flight Center, which is a NASA facility that works on mostly scientific satellites that orbit the Earth in Greenbelt, Maryland, not just on the other side of D.C. from my parents' house.
In 97, you and a few others founded Ars Digita, which was an internet professional services firm, pretty much in the peak of all of that. 2 years ago, Eve Anderson, who was one of your co-founders and still a close friend, I believe, published a fairly scathing criticism of the takeover of that company by its venture capital investors. And she claimed that, essentially, they ruined the company. It's now been 4 years since you left Ars Digita. With some perspective, how do you feel about that experience?
Well, first of all, it was a totally accidental company to begin with. I mean, the genesis of it was that, you know, having been an open source software producer for, I don't know, probably 15 years at that point, I noticed that there were an awful lot of people out there trying to build things that were sort of like Photo.net. They had user registration, they had some content management, they had discussion forums, and I thought, you know, why should these people flail about trying to get these things working with totally custom software development, taking all that risk and incurring all that expense, when I could just take the software behind Photo.net, package it up, document it, and release it. So, with the help of a couple friends of mine, Eve, Tracy Adams, Jin Choi, Benedita, that's just what we did. And we discovered that, you know, there are all these big companies that would, like Siemens and Hewlett Packard and Oracle, that would call us up and say, well, you know, we like your software and, you know, it's going to really give us a good starting point, but, you know, we want to make 10 changes. We said, you know, great. You know, how many people you got in your IT department? And they would say, you know, 10,000. So we'd say, well, you got 10,000 programmers. It shouldn't take you too long to make those 10 changes. You know, you got the source code, you got the tar file, you got the documentation from us. What more do you want? And they would say, well, you know, our programmers are really busy, and you know, we'll give you $200,000 to make these 10 changes. And we'd say, well, you know, that's only 2 weeks of work. You want to pay us $200,000 for 2 weeks of work? And they'd say, yeah. So after a few of those calls, we decided that there was a business in this, and we started a support and service business for our toolkit. And, you know, I was the CEO. I funded it, and I grew it to about $20 million a year in revenue, of which $3 million was probably profit. even after handing out a lot of bonuses to the people who'd made it profitable. So it was a little precarious, though. When you grow an organization that fast to 80 people, you know, the culture is very fragile. And probably the wise thing to do at that point would have just been to take a rest and make sure that all the new people really had absorbed the values that we'd established in the firm of, you know, putting the customer first, really trying to communicate what we'd accomplished and what we'd learned to other people through technical writing and teaching. But, you know, in hindsight, of course, it's easy to be smart. In the actual time, we weren't all that bright. And one of the things that I think was a major error was looking at some of the competitors. There are companies that, you know, you probably never, most people who listen to this will never even have heard of. Broad Vision was one. Vignette was another. These companies had gone public. They had similar toolkits in some ways. They had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank from their public offerings and sometimes secondary offerings. And we thought to ourselves, well, you know, their products aren't really very good, but with all that money, you know, we only have a couple $1 million in the bank that we've managed to preserve after all of our growth. And you know, how are we going to compete against these people that have hundreds of millions? Maybe they're not as efficient as us. But, you know, we can't be 200 times more efficient than them, and we can't rely on that. So we decided that we really needed to go public, that, you know, our customers wouldn't want to buy from a non-public company if they could buy from a public company. The capital we would raise would be, you know, good for accelerating the pace of product development. And anyway, the underwriters we talked to didn't want to talk to us. They said, well, we don't really look at companies anymore. We just... We don't care if you're profitable and have more revenue than any company we've taken public in the last few years. We just want to know who your venture capitalists are. And I would say, well, we don't have venture capital. We just have money. And they said, well, that's not good enough. So we went out and brought in some venture capitalists, and they took a minority share in the company, but somehow, you know, they're so accustomed to having a majority share, they really didn't understand that they didn't have the right to, you know, run the business without listening to anybody else. So, you know, I got into big fights with them at the board meetings, and they wanted to do it their way. So eventually, after about a year of acrimony, during which I really wasn't involved in making any decisions there, they bought my shares, and, you know, they bought control of the company, the majority control, and they ran it their way, which turned out, unfortunately, for the employees, not to be a profitable way, and now the company's gone. So if I had to do it all over...
That's the question.
If I had to do it all over again, what would I do differently? Grow a little slower, not worry too much about, you know, Microsoft, obviously, they have billions, I don't know, they probably have $20 billion of cash in the bank right now, and you know, if you really believe that if a competitor has a lot more cash than you, that, you know, they're going to crush you, well, at that point, you know, because there's Microsoft, you know, you would never do anything because obviously Microsoft is going to be able to do a better job with all their money. But I think the reality is if you understand a certain kind of customer and you're a reasonably good software engineer, you probably can hold out and, you know, trying to sustain 500% annual growth or whatever, you know, you're going to collapse from the inside just because you can't transmit your culture fast enough.
One of Eve's criticisms about that replacement management was that they didn't understand open source software. Do you think that any of today's venture-backed companies that are in the open source world are doing it right?
I don't know. One thing that's tricky about open source software, so one thing that's good about open source software that I think most people don't understand is that the customers don't want to be left as orphans. So in other words, open source is great for unsolved problems that really people don't understand very well. An open source word processor is not very interesting because, you know, the word processor was invented in the 60s by IBM, and pretty much most people now agree what a word processor should have. You know, the newer the problem, the newer the business problem, the more imperative it is that a solution be open source so that the customer can tweak and extend that system to meet those newly evolved needs. So open source is good for the customer when you have relatively novel or poorly solved problem. And at the same time, though, the customer will always have a few differences from your main source code. And to the extent that those aren't sort of those features that are required aren't rolled back into the main release, the main thread of development, they're always going to be orphans. They're always going to have this stuff on the side that they have to own and maintain, which they really don't want to do. Their business probably isn't software development, and they don't want to have ownership of software. So they'd much rather pay you, the developers of that code, to make the changes and put them back, put those features that are not core to their business but that they need, keep them in the main distribution of the software so that if they ever want to upgrade to a new version, they won't have to undertake the project of, you know, recustomizing that for their special needs. So basically, if you are in control of a piece of software, you really have the ability to charge a lot more than an ordinary IT services business to make modifications, because only you have the power to roll that into the next release. So that's one thing that is good about open source. The thing that's bad about open source is that it's very unforgiving if your costs and your time goes up. So, for example, at the early days of Ars Digita, we did a lot of things sort of MIT grad school style. We took fairly young people who were wanting to build their careers and their professional reputations. We'd have two of them do a project. So two programmers. They were totally responsible for the project. They met directly with the customer to find out what was needed. They wrote the specs. They wrote the docs. They wrote the code. They tested it with the customer. They made the enhancements as requested, and they shared the profit when it was done. So one of the things that the venture capital folks did was they noticed, hey, this isn't very conventional. You know, you don't want to have programmers selling a project or doing project management or keeping the customer happy. So, you know, they hired a salesperson to do the selling and project managers to keep the schedule and client services people. I never did quite figure out what they were supposed to do, but I think keep the customer happy. So, you know, you ended up with, they didn't want the programmers working so hard, so they hired a couple extra. So, you know, you had seven or eight people on a project where formerly you had two. And that inevitably means that more things have to be written down, that you need more meetings, and things just go slower. And the cost goes up, of course. So basically, in the closed source world, this may not be a problem. You know, you can get your freshman economics student from freshman microeconomics to tell you, well, if your prices go up this much and your delivery time goes up this much, you know, your demand goes down this much, and here's where, you know, the market will clear. The problem with open source is you always have the only good customers are the Fortune 500 type companies, and they all have an internal IT department. As soon as you are, if you're a dollar cheaper and a day faster than their internal IT department of these various companies, you know, you have a potential market in the billions of dollars. If you just, if your costs go up to the customer by $2 so that you're now a dollar more expensive, and your delivery time goes up by 2 days so that you're now a day later than they could get it done internally, your potential market goes to zero. You go from potentially billions of dollars, because they can save a little money and a little time, and, you know, there's a lot of big companies out there, to a product that nobody wants.
But that's true whether it's open source or not.
No, because if it's closed source, they can't just download the tar file and have their IT people make the needed changes, right? They'll have to go to you to make the customizations. So that's something that, you know, investors in an open source software company have to be aware of, that, you know, it's more brittle. It's a more brittle business, and, you know, inefficiencies that cascade and pile up on each other can devastate your business in a question of months. So, you know, where I had been making a profit every month, you know, a venture capitalist managed to go through, I think, nearly $50 million in cash in about a year before they flamed out. Yeah, so that's a word to the wise. If you're going to be an investor in one of these companies, watch to make sure they don't put in any costly or slow management structures.
One way or another, you've been involved with many commercial projects over the past 20 years. Of which of those projects are you the proudest?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I'm pretty proud of the course that we teach at MIT, 6171, that uses the textbook, the new textbook that's linked from my homepage. If you go to philip.greenspun.com, it's usually right there under what's new. It's not really new anymore, but I like it, so I keep it there. Software engineering for internet apps. The computer science curriculum changes very, very slowly. There's really only one or two new courses in a typical CS curriculum at most colleges, since 1970. Basically, they've added a course on crypto, because public key cryptography is a product of the early 70s. And, who knows, maybe they've added a course on internet networking or something, TCP/IP. Most of the lab-oriented courses at universities are related to building desktop apps, very complicated user interface, but all centered around one user, a mouse and a keyboard in Windows. And, the course that we developed, it's me with some help from Hal Abelson and my co-authors, Eve Anderson and Andrew Grummet. We teach the students to build multi-user applications, more like eBay or Amazon, where you have a fairly simple user interface. You don't want to have a, online community or e-commerce site or whatever that requires, a week of training for somebody to use it because they won't bother. But you have thousands of users at once, potentially. So that requires totally different tools, notably the relational database management system. And we also bring real customers into the university where the students divide themselves up into teams, and for each team we find them a nonprofit org or a small business or a group within the university that needs a little something that looks like an online community built. So they get, a lot of experience in taking the vague aspirations of a customer and turning them into concrete specs, building the thing, testing it, and in a lot of cases, ultimately delivering it.
I love in the preface to the new book, you or one of your co-authors wrote, the goal of the course is that the student finishes knowing how to build Amazon.com by him or herself. That's a heck of a, I would take that course. If I could get that in one semester or even a year, that'd be pretty good. How has the syllabus been received so far by the students?
Well, it's kind of a death march course. It doesn't have a great reputation at MIT. About 60 students sign up because it sounds like it might be fun, doing internet application development, and then they discover, oh my God, there's all this programming, it's so tedious. Because really the tools haven't improved. I mean, the tools that I used in 1994 to build a web interface to the Children's Hospital clinical care database, it's a big Oracle database they already had, but they didn't really have a good way of getting the information to doctors. So a friend of mine and I built this for the docs at Children's. Anyways, the students discover that, hey, this is pretty darn tedious. In fact, they're right. It's no easier than it was 10 years ago. But, 10 years ago, when you taught somebody to do this, you were giving them a unique skill that hardly anybody else in the world had. Anyway, so when that sinks in, quite a few of them drop out. The ones who are headed for law school or med school or business school say, hey, this isn't for me. And we're left with the 20 to 25 really hardcore software engineers who want to test themselves and, build real things. I mean, one team last semester, they built a music sharing system for Creative Commons, which is the copyright organization out of Stanford Law School. And so that's the kind of thing they build. And, the students, they take it pretty seriously.
Has the course or the material been picked up at other universities?
There are a few other schools that are using it. I think Mills College,
my wife's alma mater.
In Oakland, has been using the textbook. I haven't totally tracked it. It's not the kind of thing that universities like. Basically, calculus is a great course for the university. You pay one instructor You got this big lecture hall that you built in the 1950s, which is a sunk cost. You pile 400 tuition-paying students in there, and you teach them integration and differentiation. So that's a great course.
I mean, even with this book, there are not too many people who could teach that class.
Yeah, so this book requires, you know, basically the teaching staff to round up real-world clients and then to sit down with the students. And, you know, I don't know the answer in advance. If somebody, it's not like I'm giving them an assignment to build this mixture community for Creative Commons and I know the best way to build it. I have no idea. They, you know, we have to talk to the customers. We have to test with the users. You know, when they're doing their SQL data model, there's, you know, probably hundreds of different possibilities, some of which I personally think are cleaner than others, but I have to articulate that to them. I mean, you're coaching them and you're doing code review, but it's hard to say who exactly is right, and you really, you know, you can't just hire an undergraduate to grade their work. You really have to get down the trenches with them. And fortunately, last semester I had Ben Adida, who was, he was my top student in a intro programming course back in, I think, 1994 or 5, and now he's a grad student at MIT. So fortunately we had, you know, Ben, and then I had a lot of friends who came by to help out. But yeah, it's the kind of thing that universities just don't like. I think there's a lot of foundations that have decided that, you know, this is the way students learn the most, that if they do an open-ended project, if they work in groups.
Build something real.
Yeah, but it's not efficient. It's not cost-efficient. And therefore, you know, you're not going to see other universities. And it's not very time efficient. So for another faculty member who wants to get tenure and wants to publish, it's a lot better to teach something that looks more like math or physics.
Yeah, more structured and more traditional. Well, Philip, it's been a fascinating time spending this 45 minutes or so with you. But before I go, I have perhaps one of the most important questions. How is Alex?
Alex is good. He's about to get into the back of my little airplane, like every other leftover computer nerd from the 90s. I have a small airplane, and we're going to fly down to Washington, D.C. to see my parents, and Norfolk, Virginia, and Gettysburg, Pennsylvania to see friends. So he is quite the aviation dog now. He's been to Nome and Kotzebue, Alaska in the little airplane, and up and down the East Coast. The dog is great. He just turned, just had his 8th birthday back in January.
Well, Philip, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening to today's edition of IT Conversations. This edition was recorded on March 5th, 2004. My guest has been Philip Greenspun, and you'll find his personal website at philip.greenspun, that's GREENSPUN.com. IT Conversations is a production of RDS Strategies. Please visit our website at www.rds.com. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.